Okay, welcome back. This is lecture 3 of broadband networks. So in case some of you have not checked it out already, we tried a new experiment of putting up MP3 and real audio files of these lectures online on my website. So you all obviously have the video stuff, which is Windows streaming, media streaming, available on the WebCT, but the real audio and MP3 is also available. If you'd like to use that. Okay, I've seen that students typically use that when they want to do their homeworks and so on, or when they're preparing for exams. Okay, so feel free to use it because it can help you refresh what goes on in class, okay, in case you miss something I'm saying or so on and so forth. Okay, so in today's class, the first half of class, or the first part, first class today, we will be completing the slide set on the general introduction, which we started off on the other day. So last class we had talked about telephony, cable networks, and we just started off on internet technologies, okay? So the ideas which I'm going to be covering here is a very quick snapshot of what is going to be covered actually in a full course in internet protocols, okay? So this is a very short snapshot of all those ideas. And we'll be picking up one or two of these things later, but if you really want to understand all of these, you should be in that class as well. Okay, so let's get back to the slide set, please. Okay, in the when we left off, we were saying that if I have direct connectivity, that is, nodes are directly connected by either a shared link or a direct link, the whole thing does not scale. You cannot build large networks, okay? So because the whole setup is inefficient in some form or the other. It's inefficient either in number of links or number of nodes or number of ports, or it's inefficient in terms of its bandwidth use, or ultimately what is the average bandwidth the user can expect. So the very simple idea to build larger networks is to incorporate a notion called filtering. Okay, filtering means that packets should not appear on networks where they're not destined to. Okay, you should not send packets unnecessarily all over the place. Like broadcast violates this principle, right? So you want to filter packets such that they just go where they need to go, okay, and nowhere else. So this simple principle is actually the key to scaling. And in fact, if you look at the actual switches and routers, the better the switches are, usually they filter much better, okay? And the additional benefit they have is they are fast, they are made out of hardware, switch fabrics are optimized for forwarding efficiency and so on. So filtering, forwarding are the key to scale and efficiency, okay? So the simplest switch network you can build is just put a switch in the middle and connect all these nodes to it, okay? So this is the what's known as a star topology or a hub topology, okay? So this S is what we... Another topology where you can sort of do filtering and forwarding is a simple ring topology where packets come from one node to the other, and if the packet is not destined to me, I forward it along. So in some sense, if the packet is destined to me, I filter it out and take it. If it is not, I just forward it, okay? Here, you see the node is performing a dual function. It's acting as a host as well as a switch, okay? So whereas if in a router or in a hub type of topology, the switch is a pure switch. It does not consume packets. It's not a consumer or producer of packets. It's only a switching, pure switching node. Okay. So these are sort of semantic differences you'd like to keep in mind when you're considering architectures. So as a result, people have tried different types of architectures, ring architectures, switched architectures, hubbed architectures, bus architectures, and so on. And each of them have their own, question. So this is one of the architectures for building a network. So what happens is that if you consider a technology like FDDI, it stands for Fiber Distributed Data Interface, it turned out that that was a fairly more scalable network than Ethernet. Ethernet was at its time. So you could build a 200-mile network with FDDI. And if you look at SONET today, it is organized as rings. In some sense, you don't have lots of nodes in that network, but rings are special purpose, especially if you want to deal with redundancy, reliability, and so on and so forth. But of course, it has its limitations because ultimately all of them get connected back to the same, and you're just sharing the capacity of all of these nodes. So in that sense, this is not as scalable as you might want. Okay, so but these are. One way of thinking about it is that because each node is overloaded with the function of both a switch as well as a host, okay, that might be a cause of an inefficiency which is creeping in. Okay, it's a good question. Okay, yeah, feel free to ask questions, okay. Okay, so other topologies where you can get indirect connectivity are, we started with the star, you could go for a tree or a ring or hybrid structures of these. Okay, so you could have, in general, what is known as a partial mesh. Okay, instead of having a fully interconnected mesh, you can have partial mesh with a bunch of switches and hosts. Okay, anyway, so that is about topologies and direct versus indirect connectivity. So these are very preliminary concepts in data networking. Now, if you go to the protocol level, what are the protocol level issues which come up in data networking? So the first set of issues that crop up are when you're trying to do point-to-point connectivity. That is, you have two nodes and you want to talk between these two nodes. There are issues like framing, which we talked about last class, which comes up, error control, reliability, flow control, and so on. So, and when you're doing larger and larger networks, you'd like to get economies of scale in terms of your costly resource. What that basically means in pure English is you'd like to share anything that's costly and waste anything that's cheap. Okay, that's as simple as it gets. Okay, so circuit switching and packet switching are ways of multiplexing or sharing costly resources. So we'll quickly look at all these things. So when you talk about a reliability problem, first, what are you trying to be reliable against? Okay, so the types of issues you're trying to be reliable against are bit errors or packet errors. Okay, those are the fundamental issues we talk about when you say reliability. And it turns out that there's a forward channel and a reverse channel if you have a full duplex type communication, and you can have bit errors in both directions. Okay, so you want to be robust to this, and what happens is that to be robust to this, if you study CCN, we introduce things like sequence numbers, we introduce things like acknowledgements, negative acknowledgements, and so on and so forth, and sometimes you can have effects which are induced by the protocol itself, like duplicate packets. The notion of a duplicate packet makes sense only when there is a sequence number. Okay, so if you're sending the same packet again, a same numbered packet again, that's when you call it a duplicate, right? So again, you can have out-of-order packets, which is refers to a sequencing problem. So protocols, mechanisms you introduce themselves will have some other effects. So overall, you want to be reliable. Even in spite of these effects, you want to be reliable, okay? So that is the goal of reliability. And the model which is very successful in the internet is what is known as a temporal redundancy model. Okay, so this, again, this is a fancy term, but what it really means is that if you want to be reliable, okay, the simplest thing you do is to add redundancy in the system. Okay, so if you have an item A, like a packet A, you want to have a same copy of a packet B, okay, which is available. And if the one fails, A fails to get there, you want to send B. Okay, what do we mean by temporal is that you don't send these packets simultaneously at the same time. So you provide this redundancy over time and in a lazy manner, just as needed. Okay, so, I mean, that's as easy as it gets. So essentially the model is very simple. You send packets, and on the packet you have enough metadata like sequence numbers, error detection capabilities like a checksum or a CRC, and that detects an error for you. And then the receiver sends back status reports saying whether the whole thing got lost, and essentially encodes them in various ways, and ACKs, NACKs, and bitmaps, and selective acknowledgements. You might have learned about all these protocol mechanisms. This is a way to encode information or control information about what got through, right? And you send that back, and this reverse channel could also be erroneous. You want to be robust to that as well. And then the sender can retransmit what's not been gotten by the receiver. Okay, so this could be packets, or it could be error correction information or FEC information. And over and above that, you have a mechanism called timeout, which takes care of the case when either all the packets got lost or all these status reports themselves got lost. Okay, so these are the fundamental mechanisms, and this is the simple model, and this is how they fit together. Okay, so these models are actually treated in extensive depth in CCN, and if you like, you can go back to my slides of CCN and look at how we sort of develop this case by case. For each error, we develop a new mechanism and put it in its context. So if you put all the mechanisms together, we get the notion of a checksum that is used for detecting errors, the notion of an acknowledgement or a duplicate acknowledgement for telling me what is the status which has been received. Is it a packet correctly received or incorrectly received? And a sequence number that identifies, it's an identifier for a specific packet. And you can have either a 1-bit or an n-bit sequence number, and you use it both in the forward and reverse directions. And you use a timeout only at the sender. You do not use the timeout at the receiver. Okay, so these are so with this parsimonious collection of mechanisms, you can provide a lot of reliability capabilities. Okay, it can be shown theoretically that you can operate this on an error-free channel. You don't need any of the stuff. Or you can operate this on a channel where the forward and reverse directions just provide bit errors. Okay, you can have bit errors on them. Or if you have packet errors on forward and reverse directions, or you have protocol-induced errors like duplicates or negative acknowledgements and so on, you can eliminate some of them. You can detect duplicate of packets and so on. So this overall scheme, you can set up a bunch of schemes, either a sliding window scheme or a stop and wait scheme, or commonly called automatic repeat request schemes or ARQ schemes. Overall, they can provide all these reliability capabilities. So they are robust not only to inherent error properties, but they are also reliable against their own induced errors. Anyway, so quickly let's review stop and wait and so on. So these reliability mechanisms are also used for flow control. Flow control means that sender does not want to overwhelm the receiver, okay, which means then the receiver will not get the information anyway, right? So the simplest way is to send a piece of data and then get an acknowledgement and then send the next piece of data. So this is called stop and wait, right? So that's what it stands for. So it turns out that if you look at the utilization of the channel, especially if I have a long channel, long propagation delay channel compared to transmission time, the utilization will be lousy. Okay, so the utilization, in fact, decays in a hyperbolic manner. Okay, if you look at this function, this is a function of alpha. It's a 1 by alpha type function, which is a hyperbolic decay function. So what that means is that if this alpha is small, it's not a big deal. Okay, if this alpha is, say, 0.0001, right, this is almost like 1. So it turns out that if you look at Ethernet, right, alpha is very small. So Ethernet actually uses stop and wait, okay, even though we don't say that. When Ethernet sends a packet, if you remember, it will send a packet and then wait for a collision detect. Okay, a collision detect is like a status report. It's like a negative acknowledgement, right? And then if the collision is not detected, it will know for sure that the packet has gotten across, okay, and that it does by a timing trick. So it essentially has a negative acknowledgement procedure inbuilt or implicit within it. And the reason Ethernet works or the CSMA/CD works is because it operates on stop and wait. It's efficient because it's only a LAN technology. If you were to try to operate Ethernet over a wide array technology, this would not work, right? So stop and wait, even though it sounds simple, is used in Ethernet, even though we call it CSMA/CD, okay? And then sliding window is obviously more useful in a longer propagation delay environment where you would send multiple packets and then wait for status reports about the aggregate or the set of packets, or you can essentially take advantage of the pipelining. As you send a bunch of packets, you get a pipeline of acknowledgements coming back. And just as you studied pipelining in architecture and how it improves performance, or in manufacturing, how it would improve performance, you get a dramatic performance gain. Okay, so you have this factor N in addition to the 1 by, which multiplies the 1 by 2 alpha plus 1. Factor. Okay, so what this means is that if this N stands for the window size, so if you raise your window size sufficiently, it means that you can get a utilization of 1. Okay, so what that means is you can keep the channel always full. Okay, under this sort of thing. So this is under no error conditions. Obviously, when you start having errors and so on, you're going to have a different set of issues. Okay, so there's been a lot of analysis done in for LANs under different conditions. Okay, so now we move on to the other concepts in data networking. Concept of sharing. Okay, we already saw in telephony, we saw one form of multiplexing, which was time division multiplexing and frequency division multiplexing. One beauty of packet networks is that it added new modes of multiplexing. Okay, in particular, packet switching was a major mode of multiplexing the resource of the network. Okay, and as I mentioned several times, multiplexing, all it means is sharing. Okay, so you can think of it, if you go in a plane, you share the plane, but if you go in a car, you have your own car. So it's exactly the same thing. A plane is expensive, that's why you share it. Okay. So similarly, you would multiplex only that what is expensive. Over time, what is expensive changes. Okay. In the 1960s, when things were being built out, links were extremely expensive. And therefore, you try to multiplex links. Today, we have fiber optic technology exploding and has dramatically increased the capacity of links. And if you look at the core of the internet, I mean, links are not expensive in terms of the cost per bit. Okay. But computation is expensive and so on and so forth. So the trade-offs always keep changing over time. So a good designer always keeps sight of how the trade-offs are changing and doesn't just build systems without understanding what exactly it's optimizing. Okay, otherwise you'll be optimizing the wrong thing. Okay, another concept which is less well-known is a concept called virtualization. Okay, now you might wonder what this is, but probably what you've already heard of virtual memory. You've heard of virtual circuit in yesterday's class, right? So what is all this? What is the common thing between virtual memory and virtual circuit? Can anybody guess? So what's virtual memory? So we know what is memory, right? Some storage place. What is virtual memory? What's so virtual about it? It's not real. So anybody? Yeah, go ahead. Just take a crack. So you guys are taking architecture classes, right?
I'm sure it's a space.
Sorry?
I'm sure it's a space.
Space.
Yeah.
So you can have a larger virtual memory implemented on top of smaller physical memory, something like that, right? So you're trying to create illusions, okay? So virtual means unreal, illusionary, and so on and so forth. Okay? Anything else? So when you say connectivity, right? And yesterday I talked about having a real physical link. And connectivity can be thought of as a virtual link, is it not, right? And as I said, one of the key differences between a between the notion of connectivity and a physical link is, what is the difference? Is connectivity the same as a physical link? It's not, right? So what's different? I'm going to wake up. Huh?
It's a virtual link.
Yeah, so it's what's virtual about it? I mean, so what's so new? I mean, what's different from a realistic perspective? Yeah?
It doesn't have to be like directly connected.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't, as a user, I don't care if it's directly or indirectly connected. What affects a user in terms of its use? Like Chang gave an example of, if I have virtual memory, I have this larger or illusory memory, right? Which has a different parameter associated with it compared to physical memory. So now, suppose I give you a virtual link, what's different about it?
Once you're done sending your packets, you don't have it unless you request it again?
Right, so either you request it or you actually send another new packet, yeah. Right? So, well, I think it's there in the slides, but you've got to go back and look at it. But the key characteristic of anything virtual is that the performance parameters of it are almost always different from a physical link. So when I gave you, we talked about best effort connectivity versus a link that has a defined bandwidth. It has a defined amount of delay, defined jitter, and so on and so forth, right? So there's a well-known number, okay? Whereas in a virtual link, you are not guaranteed to have that. And the more and more guarantees you provide, that those concepts are known as quality of service, okay? So whenever we talk about quality of service, it represents an effort to go from a virtual link that gives you wishy-washy numbers to something that gives you more defined numbers, okay? So, well, the primary issue in virtualization is that the performance characteristics of whatever the virtual resource is. So you have a physical resource and you're creating virtual resources, mm-hmm. like it's a software resource, is that this virtual resource has a different performance characteristics, okay? And the reason it has different performance characteristics is because it is being built out of a physical resource. In other words, a lot of virtual resources are sharing the same physical resource, just like a lot of processes are sharing the same physical computer and doing multitasking and so on, right? So the performance seen by one process is going to be different over time, right? Anyway, so what that means, because the fundamental reason I brought it up here is that virtualization has an assumption that there is multiplexing going on underneath it. Okay, so virtualization is when you create a virtual resource, you mean essentially you're sharing something below, sharing a physical resource, and then you're having this virtual resource and then you have a level of indirection from the virtual resource, like a pointer from virtual memory to physical memory, or a pointer from, or a distributed set of pointers from a virtual link to physical resources. Like if you set up a virtual circuit, right, you have you have information at switches, like labels, which tell you what is the incoming label and what is the outgoing label. So these can be thought of as the pointer resolutions, just like you have pointer resolution in C. Okay, so multiplexing combined with indirection gives you a virtual resource. Okay, so this is a very fundamental concept in operating systems, okay, and in general in systems as a whole. So you get a dramatic amount of flexibility the moment you create an indirection. As long as that can be done cheaply, as long as software technology and computation is cheap, you can afford to do that, and you get a lot of... See, why would you want to build a peer-to-peer network today on top of an existing network, right? It is one network that is overlaid or mapped or indirected on top of the internet. Why? because the peer-to-peer network, for some reason, has more flexibility than the real network, right? The internet itself was an overlay on top of the underlying telephone network. Why? The internet provided some degree of flexibility, some degree of efficiencies. So this notion of indirection is common whenever we say overlay, or whenever we say peer-to-peer and so on, or whenever we say virtualization or virtual resources. It typically means that you're sharing some physical resource underneath and you're mapping it. The way the internet actually virtualizes is that it creates the notion of a packet that is then mapped to a link. Okay, whenever I say mapping, it is to resolve an indirection. Okay, so this is a computer science-y term, but that's what it really means. So packet actually is a virtual resource that gets mapped to bits and bytes on the physical link or physical switch that actually does a job. Switch itself maps packets from one side to the other and so on. So the forwarding table is actually a resolution of a pointer which helps me take packets from one side to the other. Okay, so virtualization is a less understood concept, but it's becoming more and more important as we are building lots of interesting virtual resources on top of the internet. Okay, so as I said earlier, connectivity itself is a virtualization created by the internet. Okay, if you remember, I drew a diagram which said that the internet looks like a big switch, right? So that it is creating this illusion that the internet is a switch, right? The interface to the internet, the best effort interface, the IP interface, creates an illusion that the internet is a switch, okay? So, and the fundamental operations of indirection means that you need to bind from the virtual resource to the physical resource and unbind, okay? So when a packet is actually transmitted on the link, you're binding it, okay? And when you're setting up forwarding tables, you're sort of binding it and so on. Okay, so similarly, when you do DNS name resolution, when you do address resolution or name resolution, all of these refers to binding operations. Okay, you're taking an address, mapping it to another address, which means you're actually resolving a pointer. Okay, this is a computer science way of understanding this. Okay, so whenever we talk about packets, slots, tokens, all of these are mechanisms for virtualization, mechanisms for taking a form of multiplexing and taking it to a higher level. Okay. Okay, so one specific form of multiplexing, which is very famous, is known as statistical multiplexing. So what's so statistical about this? Okay, so we said multiplexing just means sharing. Okay, statistical multiplexing means that not only do you share, like in frequency division multiplexing, you share and you allocate channels and so on. In statistical multiplexing, what we do is we try to exploit the statistical properties of the demand and then actually reduce the size of capacity, okay, appropriately. Okay, and then change the trade-off. So, for example, if I know that the demand is very bursty, that is, there's an average demand, but sometimes it might burst to a large peak and so on, I might actually size my capacity to be larger than the average, but I can keep it well below the peak rate. So, the moment I do this, I get what is known as a statistical multiplexing gain. Okay, because if I divide peak by the capacity, I have a huge gain. Instead of provisioning at peak, I have provisioned it at something larger than the average. Okay, obviously the gain increases as the difference between peak and average grows and you have larger room for setting at what point you want to do the multiplexing, what kind of gains you want. But then you sort of change the trade-offs, and the price you pay for this is in terms of performance. Okay, you pay for it in terms of delays, in terms of packet losses and things like that. Okay, so overall the idea of statistical multiplexing means that you do multiplexing and you structure the multiplexing such that you can exploit statistical knowledge. Okay, one mechanism of doing this is to set up a queue and to have packets actually come and sit in a queue. Okay, the moment you do that, you are allowing packets to wait. Unlike phone calls, they don't wait. I mean, when phone the voice bits come, they are immediately switched. Okay, they don't wait anywhere. Otherwise, they would lose the timing information. By making packets wait in queues, you are allowing the loss of timing information, but then you have enough information to be able to forward the packet, and you're gaining in terms of statistical multiplexing. Okay, we'll look at this in a little more detail now. Okay, one of the problems is now you have converted a multiplexing problem into a queuing problem. Okay, and in queuing, so there are separate fields in queuing, but one of the most important thing in queuing is that the arrival rate should not, on the average, be larger than service rate. Okay, you are allowed to provision your service rate above average rate, okay? But if you provision below average rate, your system will become unstable, okay? This is the first thing you learn in queuing theory, okay? So what you have to do is you have to somehow ensure stability. Okay, there are two or three ways of doing ensuring this, okay? One, the two most important ways is to, this is the telephony way, which is you reserve enough capacity so that demand will never be less than capacity. Okay, that's the telephony way. This is also known as over-provisioning. Okay, whereas the other way which is done in the internet, as is done in TCP, is to, you don't have a lot of flexibility in terms of provisioning the capacity. Somebody else provision the capacity. But what will happen is that you will dynamically detect that there is an overload at servers, at queues and so on. And the moment you detect that overload, you will back off, because instability hurts everybody else. Okay, instability hurts not only you, but everybody else. Okay, everybody loses. So it's a lose-lose game if it's instability. So this property of dynamically detecting and responding to load is known as congestion control. Okay, that's why congestion control is so important, because when you build a network which is multiplexed or statistically multiplexed and made out of packets, they will sit in queues. If they sit in queues, the stability of the queuing system is the first concern. And either you can do a reservation-based system. There are two ways. So the reservation-based system is sometimes known as quality of service type system. And the other system is to have a closed-loop system that actually detects congestion and responds to it. Okay. So even after you maintain the stability of the system, right, you have to see what is the average demand that is coming in and what is the average service rate that is being placed, that is available to serve the system. And once you have the steady state capacity and demand, it will give you an appropriate performance trade-off. Okay, so if your demand comes closer and closer, average demand comes closer and closer to capacity, you'll be paying a price in terms of some other performance parameter, in this case, delay or packet loss. Okay, so the idea of a performance trade-off means that there are some fundamental resources, and you're trying to build a system that trades off between, you're trying to build a system where there's a zero-sum game between them. You can't get something for nothing, okay, which means if you get some performance improvement in one side, you'll have to lose something else, okay. So the reason why we are allowing delays is that people can live with delays, okay, and the reason, so you want to build a more efficient system in terms of the link usage, but you're tolerating potential delays and so on, okay. So that's the idea for performance trade-off. And essentially multiplexing, the price of multiplexing is that you have both direct resource costs. You can reduce the cost of your link, etc. And you pay some cost in terms of buffer sizing and so on. But it also has intangible costs. These intangible costs are that's what makes the internet a best effort service. Because you cannot put a clear number in terms of what the performance is going to be of the internet. And you have to somehow make sure that the whole thing doesn't become unstable. So instability is the first thing you have to address in the internet. And then the next thing you would address is what is the performance you really get. Okay. So these two functions are what is cumulatively known as congestion control. Okay. Now, if you want to design large networks, what are the ways of doing it? One way is to do a circuit switching, which is essentially it is what is done in telephony, where you nail down almost a wire from end to end, and this could be a virtual wire which is also mapped to exactly the same amount of physical resources. So that is achieved through a method known as time division multiplexing that takes a circuit or a virtual circuit that's coming here, and it reserves exactly so much bandwidth or a time slot for it on the other direction and provides a switching function. And end to end, what you've nailed up looks exactly like what Alexander Graham Bell had in 1880s, okay, so it gives you the same abstraction, and in fact it gets better over time because you can do other digital signal processing type functions on it. So this is known as circuit switching. It gives you the same abstraction as a physical link. So the virtual link looks like a physical link of 64 kilobit per second, okay, and that's great for transferring voice. And one important idea here is that time division multiplexing relies completely on timing or synchronization. Okay, and all this mapping or creating this virtual resource from the physical resource can be done without the notion of headers. Okay, and the flip side of it is that resources are waste if they are not used. Okay, so it's an expensive proposition which was afforded in that day. In packet switching, essentially, instead of chopping up the links into pieces like time slots or into frequency bands, what you do is you chop up the data into pieces. Okay. So, and then you add metadata to it. In other words, metadata is just data which describes data, okay? And that is called the header, okay? So when we say a header and a payload, essentially this is, together it forms what we conventionally consider a packet. And you see what has happened is that you're chopping up data rather than chopping up the links, okay? And then with this, right, you're allowed to avoid doing a signaling to set up resources a priori, Okay, so it reduces the complexity of signaling from the network. And then it allows you a paradigm where you can store and forward. In the circuit switching world, you cannot store and forward. If you store anything, you lose timing. Because here you're going to be storing for a random amount of time, so you don't know how much, you won't know how much time you're losing and so on and so forth. So store and forward essentially implies that you don't rely on timing. Okay, that is a fundamental idea of packet switching. So packet switching is essentially a multiplexing methodology to create a virtualization known as packet, okay, and you're providing an end-to-end connectivity virtualization. Okay, it fundamentally all boils down from I want to share the network resources like switches, links, and so on, and this is my apparatus for doing that. Okay, so putting it all together, essentially what you do here in the internet is to exploit this notion of packet switching, which relies on multiplexing of links in a statistical manner, or statistically multiplexed links, and locally provisioned. The link capacities are provisioned by the operator. You don't, when I send traffic from here to the other side on the internet, I don't know what the capacities link has been provisioned, right? And you don't run signaling calls, etc. At the cost of having a self-descriptive header, at the cost of requiring computation of the end systems and intermediate nodes, at the cost of putting queues, at the cost of delays, okay, but all these costs sound trivial today, but they were not trivial when packet switching was designed. Because the reason this has become interesting is because over the last 30, 40 years, computation has become cheaper. Okay, and computation, and you can build hardware to buffer and so on. So that is the fundamental driver which has allowed packet switching to happen. Okay, so in terms of maintaining stability of the system, you have still two options. And we'll learn when we study quality of service that we can actually try the second option as well, which is running a signaling protocol to run reserve resources for yourself. Or you can run an end-to-end congestion control protocol like TCP does. So I'm not going to cover congestion control in this class, but it's covered in detail in internet protocols. Okay, so essentially what has happened is that in spatial multiplexing, you chop up the resource itself into pieces, like we chop up the link into pieces like frequency bands or time slots. And in temporal multiplexing, you chop up the data or what is being used of the resource into pieces. Like the information is being chopped up, not the resource itself. So, and you try to access the resource over time or share the resource over time. So that's called temporal. Whenever I say temporal, it's over time. And spatial means you're chopping up. So this is like cutting a cake. And this is like saying that the cake keeps reappearing all the time and you're getting new piece, slice of the cake over time. Okay. So packet switching is potentially more efficient primarily because it allows both these modalities, whereas circuit switching allows primarily the first modality. It allows you to break up the network in terms of circuits. It does provide some temporal multiplexing at the level of circuits themselves, but within a circuit, you either use it or lose it. So, and nobody else can use it. Anyway, so what we have covered so far is some fundamental concepts, a quick review of concepts in terms of how do you do point-to-point connectivity and how do you build larger networks and so on. Okay, now let's quickly review schemes of both direct connectivity and indirect connectivity, and what are these things we call routers, hubs, and what are the fundamental functions, okay? So we are going to use these notions as we go forward in our class, okay? And then, so you would have studied multiple access LANs in detail in your earlier class, and multiple access LANs, essentially, you want to build a network that doesn't go too far. In other words, the propagation delay is not very far off, but you might still want to have a lot of nodes on it, and so on. So you want to build a scalable multiple access LAN. Okay, so in some sense, you want to have limited scalability both in terms of number of nodes you want to connect, number of distance you want to go, and the limited scalability is due to nothing else but the limited filtering capabilities. Okay, you want to put cheaper components there that don't process, that don't run sophisticated protocols for filtering. Therefore, the whole thing doesn't scale. Okay, I'll tell you what I mean by this in a moment. Okay, so first thing you do is if I have a medium that is shared, you try to build an arbitration mechanism. Just like you have a bus and you have a bus arbitration protocol, you have medium access protocols. The only difference is in a bus, all the elements are close by and the propagation distance between elements of a bus are very close by. Whereas in a medium access protocol, in an Ethernet, the bus probably extends for several tens or hundreds of microseconds. So you have a fairly significant delay in the arbitration. So arbitration is a little more trickier. So in this process, we learn a lot of concepts like addressing, forwarding, bridge switch, and so on. Okay, so let's take a look at what are all these things. So there are three broad classes of MAC protocols. The simplest MAC protocol is to take the channel or the resource and chop it up. Okay, so this, we have seen all this earlier itself. So FDM or frequency division multiplexing or TDM chops up a resource. I have a link, I chop it up into frequency bands, right? That's called FDM. Similarly, TDM chops up a link into time slots. Now, there are variants of this known as TDMA and FDMA. Okay, so what is the new A which is added? Time division multiple access. So what's the big deal in access? So the thing is that the only difference is that in a TDM or FDM system, you have the link in one place and you have the equipment like a switch in one place and you chop up the link right there. Whereas in a TDMA system, the way the chopping is done is distributed manner. So the way you chop up or partition the channel itself is in a distributed manner. So you have nodes which are distributed, they want to talk to each other, and they, in a distributed manner, they decide to chop up the link into time slots. In a distributed manner, they decide to chop up the link into wavelengths, or in a distributed manner, they decide to chop it up into, say, frequency slots, okay? So that is the only difference between TDMA and FDMA. Otherwise, they are all the same. And similarly, another way to handle the sharing is consider a single link, okay? And if I have a bunch of nodes, a bunch of users that want to share the link, right? You can provide a round-robin service to them, okay? So provide the, this is a simple idea in process sharing, right? So I have the computer and that is the processor, and I have several processes which want to share it. You provide access to one process, and then after a time slot, you provide the access to another process for an arbitrary amount of time, okay? So within some bounds. And as soon as a process releases a resource, the resource is made available to another process, okay? In other words, you have some, even though you are sharing it piece by piece, you are allowing efficiency in the process. As soon as the process is released, you're giving it to somebody else. In TDM, if a process is not being used by one slot, you cannot allocate it to another slot. So there's no flexibility in terms of use of the of transferring the use of resources among users. So taking turns essentially means that it's an emulation of round-robin service. So what you want to do is I have some distributed set of nodes, and I want to take turns. Okay, first you send, then I send, and you send, and so on. So essentially you want to emulate a distributed round-robin. Okay, so one way to do that is to build a token ring. Okay, so token ring sounds fashionable and new, okay, but it's all nothing but just a round robin implemented in a distributed manner. Okay, so this is one thing you have to remember in networking. Okay, it all purports new ideas, but most of them are distributed implementation of some very, very simple idea in a centralized context. Okay, so congestion control, for example, is a very complex topic, but it is a very simple idea in single queuing system. If you want to maintain stability of a system, there are some standard ways of doing that. Okay, when you want to take it to a large distributed system, there are other considerations, but fundamentally, functionally, it is the same thing. Okay, okay, and the other way to access a channel, you will never do this in a single system. That is, suppose I have a bunch of processes available, right, and they want to share a processor. Just provide access on random, okay. Or, for example, in this class, you want to talk, everybody just talks at the same time, or everybody talks whenever they want to. So it would be inconceivable within a class context to do that. But in a shared bus context, it makes sense. You can allow random access and do some simple arbitration techniques to dramatically increase the efficiency, which is what Ethernet does, okay? So these are three broad classes of sharing, okay? And we'll quickly go through these classes, and you'll see that there's nothing beyond it. I mean, they have all these fancy names, but the ideas are very simple, okay? The overall, I think the most important thing is the whole thing is decentralized. It's a distributed sharing mechanism or distributed multiple access mechanism, and you want it to first be efficient and stable and so on, and you want it to be fair in some sense, and the whole thing has to be simple. Okay, so as I said, the simplest thing is to do channel partitioning like we did in the telephony world. The only difference here, you're doing it in a different in a distributed manner. So one simple idea is to create a time frame and say that in the first part of the frame, node 1 can transmit, in the second sub-frame, node 2 can transmit, and so on. So this is like a T1 frame, right? So the only difference is that people know when they need to transmit, and they'll just stick their packets in during those slots, okay? That's all, TDMA, finish, okay? So similarly, you can do an FDMA in a similar manner, okay? So the taking turns part of it, there are two ways of doing it. One we just talked about is a token passing protocol, like, or a token ring. What you do is I transmit a packet, and as soon as I'm done transmitting, I'll send this token to the next guy. Okay, assuming that this distance from here to here is small, which is true in a LAN, not in a wide area network, it is also reasonably true in a metropolitan area network. Okay, the time to transmit a token from one to the next is not prohibitively high. Okay, therefore you can afford to get away with this. So the when you do that, I get my turn, and then I finish my transmission and then send the token to the next one. So this is like a round robin implemented in a distributed manner, leveraging the fact that in round robin you go around, and the simplest topology you can come up with is round. Okay, so that's why it's a ring. Okay, fairly obvious, right? Okay, then the another way to do this taking turns is, instead of doing it in a distributed way, you can have a central arbitrator called a polling station, where this polling station will ask, do you want to send packets? Go ahead and send. Then as soon as you're done, it token comes back to the arbitrator and goes to the next one, says, do you want to send a packet? You send. Right? So this is essentially a round robin mechanism handled centrally. Okay, and you can see the obvious faults with it, right? I mean, it's a central thing. If it goes down, everything goes down, and so on and so forth. Okay, so here you can sort of look at all the issues here, right? I mean, immediately in this, you have a single point of failure, you have some polling overhead. If the different nodes are situated differently, at a different distances from the polling station, you're going to have trouble. Okay, but very interestingly, IBM's SNA architecture works this way. I mean, it has some levels of hierarchy, but the old mainframe works this way. I mean, you have terminals, and the supercomputer, the mainframe will just poll the terminal. Do you want to send something? Do you want to send something? Okay, it's a very simple round robin implemented in a central manner. Token passing is what is done in token ring. Okay, obviously, since IBM built the mainframe, it knew how to do round robin. Okay, they came up with a way of doing round robin in a distributed manner. So IBM built the token ring protocol, which was successful in the sense the only new ideas here is a token. And probably the most interesting observation was that passing a token from one node to the other is like giving a chance from one node to the other, right? So in a central situation. And that is a low overhead action, therefore the whole thing can still be very efficient. So token overhead increases and latencies increase as you have larger and larger links. And you have to some extent a single point of failure, the token, but they came up with sophisticated schemes to regenerate tokens if they died, if rings got cut, there were dual rings in FDDI and so on and so forth. Okay, so there are ways to deal with this. And another way to do polling, instead of doing it in a centralized manner, you can do a distributed polling. Okay, and this is another very simple trick. Okay, what you do is you have a special frame known as a reservation slot, and you have you have a bit for every node. Okay, a node knows its number, or in other words, it's a position on that frame. Okay, it goes to its array position and then sets its number to 1, saying that I want to send transmit. So essentially, this is known as a reservation frame, and once the reservation frame goes through the network, everybody knows who's going to transmit, okay, in what slot. So this is like doing a round robin, but instead of having a central station, you are doing it in a bus type architecture. So it's interestingly, you can do this in a bus, okay. And in fact, one of the IEEE standards was called token bus, okay. And another standard which came out in the metropolitan area was called DQDB, okay. Most of these are already dead, so that's why you've not heard of it, okay. So all of these tried methods like this, okay. And in random access, things again started off from the simplest thing. Okay, another important thing to remember when we are studying these kinds of protocols and from a historical perspective is to realize that you are now in the middle of history. Okay, so you are going to create history for the future. So you have to take these ideas and figure out what are the fundamental trade-offs. What is the simplest way I can create new protocols for the future, and what can these protocols teach me? Okay, so what are my trade-offs today? And what is the simplest way of dealing with the trade-offs and configuring systems and building systems, even though it might sound ridiculously simple, but usually the ridiculously simple things win. Okay, so if it addresses the right trade-offs. Okay, now, the ridiculously simple thing which a random access protocol did was speak whenever you want. This was known as the Aloha or Hello protocol. Okay, so this was built in Hawaii, where they wanted to build a radio network, radio-based packet network, and you needed a way of distributed arbitration. And one simple way was just say hello, okay? and start using the channel right away. Okay, so in other words, it was possible for multiple people to speak at the same time and actually collide and waste the channel for a period of time. Okay, so that was called Aloha protocol. And it turned out that its utilization was very lousy, you know, it's like 18%. Okay, essentially, one thing randomization teaches you is that if there are just a few nodes, okay, there's a standard problem in probability you learn called the birthday problem. Okay, so what is the probability that two of you have, and suppose I pick any arbitrary two of you, what is the probability that you have the same birthday? Okay, any pair of you. Okay, it's called a birthday problem. Okay, it turns out that the probability is very small if the class size is small. Okay, but but then suddenly the probability is almost zero for a long time, and then suddenly it shoots to one. Okay, and the transition happens, or phase transition happens at root n. Okay, if you take the number of people in the class, and if there are the root n is a point when this sort of transition happens. So what it means is that you can use randomization to your to avoid collisions, to avoid conflicts, if only a few transmit at any time. So Aloha essentially says that, just use randomization. I mean, if you transmit at random time, you transmit at random time, very unlikely you will collide. This is true, provided we don't have a lot of offered load. But if the offered load increases, the capacity decreases. I mean, so the worst case utilization can be pretty bad. Okay, but the best case utilization can be 100%. I mean, if the randomization patterns turn out to be good, then it's good. So you should notice that this is the worst case utilization. Best case can be quite good. So then people said, okay, this sounds pretty interesting. Let me try to improve it a little bit. Okay, I won't be just dumb and random. Okay, I will try to be smart random. Okay, that's known as CSMA-CD. Okay, so CSMA basically means that let me first sense the channel and see if it's actually active. If somebody's active, what's the point of jumping? Okay, so there's no point being random. I know there'll be a collision. Okay, this is obvious. Then CSMA-CD means that it exploits the fact that you're having the propagation delay is quite large compared to your transmission delay. That is the fundamental idea in CSMA-CD. If your propagation delay is quite large compared to your transmission delay, I'm sorry, it's the other way around. If your transmission delay is quite large, it takes a long time for you to transmit the packet, but you can quickly detect if you have propagated one way and come back the other way. Okay, essentially what will happen is when you hear the signal back yourself, you can ask, has there been a collision? Okay, and when the collision occurs, you can stop transmitting. So then essentially when the collision happens, the penalty you pay for a collision is small. So the amount of time the channel is brought down due to collisions or such conflicts is small. So CSMA-CD reduces the conflict penalty in addition to CSMA. Okay. So obviously if you do this, you're pretty good. I mean, so if you are dealing with a network that's not too large in terms of scope, in terms of distances, okay, that's such that the propagation delay then starts becoming comparable to transmission delay, right? That's when CSMA-CD starts breaking down. Otherwise, if you have small propagation delays and large transmission delays, it's quite good, right? That's why it works well for up to 100 megabits per second. In fact, what they did I think I mentioned this last class, in the original Ethernet, you had about 500 meters, which was allowed per segment. And when you wanted to build a higher speed system and you wanted to use CSMA-CD, they just cut down the maximum distance to 100 meters. Okay, and once you do that, essentially, you're reducing the propagation delay. Okay, because the transmission delay has dramatically reduced by order of 10. Right, so, and propagation delay was reduced by order of 5. So, the trade-off still worked out. Okay, that's why 100 megabit Ethernet became possible. Okay, and so the corollary is that in gigabit Ethernet, you don't use CSMA-CD. Okay, because the transmission delay is extremely small. So compared to propagation, any propagation delay. I mean, so initially they wanted to cut down it to 10 meters and so on, and then it didn't work out. But then new fiber and new propagation techniques allowed you to go 100 meters, but still CSMA-CD was deemed to be too costly. So essentially you went from a shared network to a switch network. So there's no arbitration to be done. In a purely switched network, it's only two nodes talking to each other. Anyway, so the moral of the story is that randomization, especially if done intelligently, is a very powerful thing. Okay, in fact, if you look at Keshav's book, one of the last chapters, and I think among your, by the way, the homework is assigned today, I forgot to mention, the homework is online. Okay, you need to download it from the WebCT, And this time I've kept the homework pretty simple, okay, straightforward. All you have to do is you have to catch up on reading. Okay, you have to catch up on lots of reading, okay. And then just to test whether you really read or not, I have a whole bunch of true or false questions, okay. So you just have to say true or false for each of them, okay, but there are 60 of them, okay. So you can't get away without reading. So so you have to read, and so anyway, so as part of the reading, you'll come across randomization technique. So randomization, even though we all hate probability, is a very powerful technique. Okay, it is a very powerful technique to break collisions. It's a very powerful technique to break ties, especially if used intelligently. Okay, so CSMA does that. Okay, now probably, I mean, all these techniques seem to be reasonably simple. Okay, in fact, the companies which developed these technologies, all of them brought it to a stage where it could go to mass market. Okay, so why did Ethernet win out? Okay, so in terms of product development and complexity, everything became manageable in terms of LAN technologies. But there was some intangible in terms of trade-offs which Ethernet addressed, which the others did not. Do you know what that was? Why is Ethernet successful today? This is the question. Why is Ethernet successful today where, hugely in comparison to Token Ring or anything else? Right. Why don't you see DQDB? Yeah. I mean, I'm just telling you that at the time, right, in mid-80s early 80s, you could find Ethernet equipment and Token Ring equipment. You should talk to old IBM guys. I mean, around the same price points. So product development-wise, people had solved the problem of getting, sort of economies of scale to a point.
The existing cabling could be used better for Ethernet, and Token Ring required a new
Yeah, exactly. So that was the key thing. So it turned out that the real cost, okay, here's important lessons in system design, okay. In system design, actually, is a very simple model which Keshav talks about in his book, is that there are trade-offs, okay, in terms of time, space, money, and all these other things. So you have to identify the correct trade-off, okay. This is a common problem in industry. I mean, companies go out of business and identify the wrong trade-off, or they spend too much money or too much cost, right? So the primary economic driver was in terms of operational costs. Okay, in product markets, there are two issues. One is how much is the capital expense for buying new equipment and setting things up, and then another is what is the operational cost. Operational costs are two part. One is how much does it take to install and set up this network to get it going for the first place, and the second operational cost is once I set up this network, it's going to be alive for a long, long time. Okay, how long? What is the cost needed to manage this network and operate it over time? Okay, so it turned out that Ethernet was the only one technology which could actually leverage existing cabling or existing conduits, so that you don't have to build new conduits, you don't have to build new cables. And even though Ethernet did a first mistake, it was developed as a coaxed cable technology. It was tied to coaxial cable, but then they were smart enough to port the essential aspects of the technology to twisted pair and to a tree architecture. Even though you had a logical bus architecture for the operation of Ethernet, for the operation of CSMA CD, they mapped this virtualization to a physical tree architecture. So you see the use of virtualization and the flexibility it provides, right? The moment they did that, immediately the market took off. Okay, the reason was that you could leverage existing assets, and you could leverage, and the rollout time was very simple. And then overall, all these protocols are fairly simple to operate, and so on, right? So then essentially people became entrenched, just like why do you use Windows GUI and not go to some Linux GUI, right? So once people get used to an interface, or once they are used to the operations of one, it's very hard to switch them over to another one. So this is one very common thing we see in network economies. So that is primarily the major thing that tipped. Okay, so that's why in product markets, the right set of requirements. So people do focus a lot beyond capital expense. What is the price of single equipment, to the issue of operational expense. Is it easy to manage? Is it easy to operate, etc.? Okay, so Ethernet teaches us a very important lesson in that context. Anyway, so given that, we are going to go forward and just talk about Ethernet and in the Internet context, right, because it's ubiquitous. So Ethernet essentially has the notion of a segment, okay, and the segment is a piece of cable that is terminated by repeaters. Okay, now these repeaters are digital amplifiers. So they pick up a digital signal and then regenerate it, create a clean signal, and throw it on the other wire. They don't have any other intelligence. Okay, they just They don't have any software functionality. So that's why they are called layer one devices. And these segments are fairly small, 500 meters per segment. Okay, and there's also a limit on number of segments you can have, four segments or so. Okay, so anyway, so we talked about this. Then obviously you can't build large networks if there's going to be limitations on number of segments and the number of nodes per segment and so on, right? So if you want to build a large network, you need to interconnect these repeated segments together. This set of repeated segments essentially formed what is known as a collision domain. This is a domain in which every node situated on this domain will see collisions. Okay, in other words, if a collision happens on the wire, I'll see it. Okay, so if you want to interconnect collision domains, essentially what you do is you buy a device called a layer 2 device, which is called a bridge. Okay, so the only thing it does is it does filtering. Okay, now here we are back to the idea of filtering, right? It sees a packet on one side, takes the packet, actually decodes it, figures out what it is, okay, and most importantly figures out what its address is, and then figures out whether the packet should remain on the same LAN or it should be forwarded to another LAN or another collision domain. So you see the notion of filtering and forwarding, right? Filtering is based upon the address, and filtering is also based upon a forwarding table which a layer 2 device builds. It's known as a bridge forwarding table, right? So this is also called bridge. Okay, so the key idea of a bridge is that it's a layer 2 device, which means it has more intelligence than just repeat ring, and it examines the header. Most importantly, it examines the address field of the header, and it filters. Okay, and the way it builds its forwarding table is not sophisticated. Okay, it doesn't run a routing algorithm to build a forwarding table. It just snoops. Okay, it doesn't communicate with other bridges to build a forwarding table. It just snoops on the packets and sees, oh, packet, this packet has a source address here. Okay, when I have another packet which comes with this destination address of A, I will send it on this direction. Okay, so just by local snooping, okay, in an opportunistic manner, it builds up this forwarding table. Okay, snooping can be quite effective in several circumstances. And if you go through several instances of way protocols have been designed, there are several cases like in wireless networks, 3G networks, a lot of snooping ideas there. Snoop on the packets, do some packet processing on the way, and then send it out, etc. Right? So bridge is basically a snooping device, which means it's not very intelligent. It doesn't talk to anybody else. Just localized knowledge, opportunistic knowledge it uses. Oh, by the way, you also hear of a word called hub. Hub is essentially a way to build a tree-type topology, but make it look like a virtual bus. Okay, and essentially what it is a repeater. It takes signals on one direction and then throws it on all other interfaces. Okay, it also provides some fault detection and so on. But it's essentially a layer one device. It is used especially in the 10 base T deployments. 10 base T stands for twisted pair. Okay. Okay. So when we use the word router, essentially what we mean is that even though you can create networks which have these collision domains which are connected by bridges, this network also doesn't scale. You know why? The reason is because when the bridges see a packet and they look at its address, and that address doesn't appear in the forwarding table, they don't know what to do. Okay, and then they panic. They send this packet everywhere. So they resort to broadcast quite often. Bridges can resort to broadcast the moment they see a packet, they don't know what to do. Okay, and as I said, broadcast has no filtering, right? So bridges quite quickly, even though they do some preliminary filtering, they can fall back to an unfiltered state. That is, they take packets and throw them everywhere. The moment you throw packets everywhere, the whole thing doesn't scale. You are using network capacity which could be used more efficiently elsewhere. So routers are distinguished by the characteristics that they never broadcast packets. When they get a packet from one direction, even if they don't know where to send it, they will send it exactly to one other router. So they'll pass the buck, but they will never broadcast. So that's why routers are said to terminate broadcast domains. So the set of bridged collision domains is actually called a broadcast domain. Okay, and in internet speak, it is called a subnet. Okay, so the most important thing about routers is that it doesn't, even though this is very ill understood, people think the router is a magical thing, but it's not. It's a very simple thing. It does filtering. It never allows broadcast to propagate. It never allows MAC multicast to propagate beyond it. Okay, and the way it does that is it passes the buck, but then it knows how whom to pass the buck to, right? So essentially it builds up a forwarding table in a more intelligent manner. Okay, the way it does is instead of just opportunistically looking at the local information, it talks to other routers, and this way it talks is known as a routing protocol. So it runs a separate protocol or a separate set of control information around to get some sense of global topology. If it doesn't know any global topology, it will forward it to some other node, and the overall system will make sure that the whole thing will not keep looping forever. Okay, so that's the idea for Outer. It has beautiful filtering capabilities. Okay, but the way it filters is that it works on top of a bridge. In other words, it works at layer 3. It has to have another ID of an address that has special characteristics about it, okay, which allows it to do the filtering correctly, okay, which allows it to talk to other routers and build intelligent forwarding tables, etc. Okay, and that is what is known as a hierarchical address. So in an Ethernet address is known as a flat address because it doesn't give you any clues about whether the where the destination is and where you want to send the packet. Okay, so quite often you can see a flat address and not know what to do. Whereas in a internet address is a dual purpose address. It is not only the ID of a machine where you want to send, ID of an interface where the packet has to go to, it is also the ID of the network to which the packet belongs to. So in fact, the network address is encoded within the packet address. And the way you extract the network address is to apply a subnet mask on the IP address. Okay, and you sort of extract the network address. And this is the network address provides you a tool to which you can, you are guaranteed to maintain a forwarding entry for every network address. Okay, and that is guaranteed through the routing protocol. So that way you'll never get a packet which you not know what to do. Okay, you will send it to a default router, and some routers in the world will have paths to every possible, and those routers are known as core routers. Okay, so just like, I mean, you can't keep passing the buck beyond the White House, right? Buck stops at the White House. That's one of the famous usage. So the buck in networking stops at the core routers. Okay, anyways, so the notion of a switch, right, a router and a switch, what's the difference? A switch is probably a more fundamental conceptual idea. The switch is the one which has any form of filtering and forwarding capability. It's a generic term, whereas a router is a special term which delimits broadcast domains. Okay, a switch can refer to a layer 2 switch, which means the filtering ideas are only layer 2 ideas. It's a bridging idea. So a layer 2 switch is nothing but a bridge. Okay, it also has a switch fabric or a hardware forwarding capability that's very fast. A layer 3 switch is a router which does filtering at layer 3 and has a good fabric. Okay, anyway, all these are functions. The way you buy, when you buy an equipment, I mean, the packaging of these functions vary. I mean, you might get something which is called a router, but it also could be a switch, etc. Okay, so the summary of all this is the following. Okay, the key things you need to remember about how you build scalable networks is that when you have a shared domain, right, you try to limit the scope of sharing. You try to limit the scope of collisions. Okay, so that is done through the notion of collision domain. Okay, and you had the notion of a hub or repeater, which allowed you to map this collision domain on top of various physical networks, especially existing networks like PBX networks, etc. And then bridges are not great filtering tools beyond a point. So at the end of the day, you need routers which demarcate this bridge network, or what is also sometimes called an extended LAN, and no broadcast go beyond this. Okay, and that is the reason why the internet scales. Okay, routers know each other, can find each other, and they don't propagate broadcast. If broadcast were to pass a router, the internet wouldn't be this size. Okay, it's as simple as that. Okay. Anyway, so we talked briefly about addressing, okay, and if you look at the Ethernet address, right, I mentioned that it's a flat address. So what is the meaning of flat address? Flat address means that there's no structure in the address which can be leveraged for the purposes of forwarding, okay, for the purpose of filtering in particular. So the most important thing in the Ethernet address is that the address structure does not explicitly acknowledge indirect connectivity. See, I said that if you can build a bridge network, right, it's an indirect connected network. But this fact is not encoded in the address. So let me give you a simple example. Maybe I should draw it here. Okay, can we point here, please? Okay, so suppose I have a node B here and a node A here, right? And a packet just shows up here. Says destination address is B, it's coming from source A. Okay. Now, there is nothing in the structure of B that leads me to believe that it's here or here. Okay. This bridge does not have any information about whether it's here or here. Okay. The only way it can try to guess that is that if it sees some other packet for B which happened to go this direction. So the address does not contain any hint about where B is. So in other words, you don't know whether B is directly connected to you, whether it's here or whether it's indirectly connected to you. It does not explicitly encode that information. Okay, so that is the simple idea. So you cannot use sophisticated filtering. Okay, so what does a router do? Can we go to the next slide, please? Yeah, we are seeing it here, right? So, okay, so I'll just skip the slide for a moment and come back to this. Whereas, oh man, what happened to this? Here. If you look at an IP address, right, there is a clear demarcator which tells you how the network ID is encoded within the source, within the address. So, in fact, if you chop up the address and this part is the address of the network, so then what you can do is you can build a routed network that routes not to the destination endpoint, but it routes to the destination network. So, tell you what that means, essentially, if this is 32 bits, right, and I would normally have to keep entries for 2 to the power of 32 possibilities if I want to maintain full connectivity, right? If I demarcate it earlier, say 16 bits, I need to keep a maximum of only 2 to the power of 16 entries. So my routing table can be dramatically smaller. In fact, today's largest routing tables in the internet are about 100,000 routes. Okay, the core routers in the internet are about 100,000 routes. I mean, you see that it's not very large, right? It's little more than 2 to the power of 16 or so, 2 to the power of 20 max. And that's about it. So what it means is that you can, essentially all these routers are maintaining information about routes to networks, not routes to end hosts. Okay, so that is one key idea. So once you can do that, then in addition to that, routers talk to each other. Okay, in other words, bridges are just local. They just snoop around and figure out what they want to do, whereas routers can talk to each other and then figure out who's going to be the next hop. Okay, and that process is known as a routing protocol. Okay, so that is the sophisticated filtering function that routers do, and therefore they don't need to panic and forward packets everywhere. Okay, let's get back here. Okay, so in other ways, there seems to be an apparent structure in the Ethernet address. Okay, there seems to be some fields called OUI. Okay, you'll be always hit by a barrage of these sort of terms, which are primarily meaningless terms. All this stands for is a way. There seems to be a hierarchy in the way Ethernet addresses are allocated out to organizations. Like 3Com has its own OUI and Cisco has its own OUI. This is sort of a number which is sent to a vendor so that they can make sure that when I make an equipment with an Ethernet address and you make an equipment with Ethernet address, there's no possibility that they can collide. In other words, you won't have address non-uniqueness. Okay, one way, whenever you want to avoid collisions, right, there are two ways. One is an administered way. Okay, and this is the administrative mechanism taken by IEEE. Okay, in fact, if you are familiar with AppleTalk has a very cool way of assigning an address. It just picks addresses by random. Okay, you just pick up an address in random. Okay, it has some 3 bytes and so on, 2 of its bytes, it just picks at random. So it essentially uses randomness, pretty much like how Ethernet uses randomness and Aloha uses randomness to avoid collision, right? Here you're trying to avoid address collision. So therefore, obviously, AppleTalk cannot scale for large sizes, right, because it has the birthday problem. If there are too many nodes, there's a good probability that there'll be a collision. And if you go to the IP class, you'll learn about IPv6 or next generation IP. And one of the modes which IPv6 allows is exactly the same thing. You can actually select an address at random and start transmitting. Okay, that it's very nice because it has a property known as auto configuration. I don't need to talk to anybody to figure out who I am, right? So I know who I am. I just come up with my own ID. Right. Okay. Anyway, so the structure in the Ethernet address is only an administrative structure or an address allocative structure. It has nothing to do. I might have a network with network OUIs from different people. There's no structure in the number of OUIs or the ways OUIs have been assigned. Okay. It turns out that several LAN software-based LAN protocols like Novell, NetWare, and so on, they want to assign their own addresses. They want to assign addresses with some structure. Okay. So there is a bit here which indicates, I think this, it's called an administrative bit or GL bit, which says that this address is a hardware address or a software address. So it is possible for you to take Ethernet and actually build hierarchies, okay, through software control. And in fact, some of the software from Microsoft and Novell do that. Okay, but this is done through a sort of fancy bit setting. And another bit stands for multicast. Because the LAN is a single sort of bus type of abstraction, you can send a packet to a subset of receivers. Okay. So there's nothing much interesting in the address in the frame format. The most interesting thing is the fact that most of the frame is occupied by the address. So address is probably the most important thing in any frame format. If you look at this 6 plus 6 bytes out of, I mean, the only remaining bytes are 6 plus another 6 bytes, right? There's other 6 bytes are for error detection and some multiplexing field. Okay, otherwise everything else is address. So the most important thing in connectionless network is the address. Okay. Okay. So in terms of internetworks, so we saw how to build a sort of bridge network and so on. Okay, in internetworks, there are two issues. One is scale. We continue to have the issue of scale. And the other issue is heterogeneity. Okay, I might have different networks and I want to tie these things together to create this new universal network called the internet. Okay, so the internet looks like one big switch. Okay, so all the problems in the internet, in fact, the entire course Internet Protocols deals with this exactly all the problems stemming from this, from how to deal with heterogeneity, how to deal with scale. Those are the only things. So if you look at the concepts which come out of that class, you will deal with heterogeneity issues like, okay, I have to translate one address to the other. Okay, this translation is a form of pointer resolution. Okay, so it's called address resolution. When you talk about name resolution, it's like following a pointer from a human readable address to a network readable address, right? So from a name to an address and so on. We hear of overlays which get mapped to this thing, lower level things, like the internet was mapped to lower level stuff, IP was mapped to layer 3 is mapped to layer 2, etc. Okay, all these ideas, fragmentation, I won't go into great detail, but these are all just to handle heterogeneity. And hierarchical addressing, routing, naming, address allocation, congestion control are all mechanisms to handle various issues surrounding scalability. Okay, so if you want to study scale, you can clearly understand how each of these fit into the overall picture. Okay, and as I said, the primary forwarding mechanism is that address has a structure which aids the forwarding process and primarily which aids the filtering. You'll know when I see an address whether the node is directly connected or indirectly connected. Okay, so once I figure that out at every node, then I can do intelligent forwarding. Okay, so, excuse me. Okay, so again, this is, so the price of having structured addresses is that you have to draw boundaries around a bunch of nodes and label them differently. Instead of arbitrarily labeling these as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, this is known as a flat address space. This is what Ethernet looks like, or bridged Ethernet looks like this. Whereas in IP, you have this 3.2, 3.1, you have some hierarchy. There's one part which belongs to the network side, another part which belongs to the host side, and which basically draws an implicit boundary around this 3 network and 1 network. So then you can have these special black nodes which forward from one network to the other. They can be sort of suboptimal in the sense that even though there's a direct connectivity from 3.2 to 1.1, you cannot use that route. You're only allowed to go through this sort of inefficient route. So you trade off some inefficiency for dramatic gain in scalability. Okay. So that's the basic deal. Okay. So if you look at internet routing, right, and you compare it to telephony routing that we saw earlier, there are very different, it's completely different drivers that push these areas. So internet was built as a cheap overlay. Okay. Cheap means in relative terms, overlay on using unreliable components on top of the telephone network. It was designed to use the power of computation. Okay. And the power of statistical multiplexing on top of this network. Okay. So that's packet switching was the driver for the internet we often learn, right? So that is what it is. And so if you have cheaper components, they are likely to fail more often, right? Because they're unreliable. And so the topology keeps changing. Both the links and nodes can keep going down all the time because of software problems. I mean, even today we have bugs, right? Your node at home, like your Windows box keeps going down all the time, right? So in a network, what this means is that topology changes often, so you need dynamic routing. Topology is also not a full mesh because it's a cheaper network. So you need to have more sophisticated routing to learn about the topology, etc., right? What you're trading off is that you're trading off computational capabilities. End systems also have substantial computational capabilities, so they can actually implement complex protocols like TCP. So this gives to a new paradigm called end-to-end paradigm, which you often hear. Essentially, it means that end systems are more intelligent, so put more functions or place more functions in the end systems rather than and have a dumber internetwork. So versus the intelligent network, which we saw in telephony, right? Signaling network is sometimes called the intelligent network in telephony. So it's a diametrically opposite vision. Okay, another economic effect of having cheap networks is that several organizations said, oh, I can build such a network. I can build my own intranet and so on. So what happened was there were several organizations which turned out building their own networks, unlike the AT&T, which built out the telephony network, and there was just a single player there. Now here there were several players, and as a result, you had multiple administrative clouds which needed to talk to each other. So this is a very different structure compared to a single huge administrative cloud, right? And it has several implications in the sense that if I have many clouds, each cloud is necessarily smaller, right? So I won't have the same economies of scale or same sort of control. I need interoperability. I need simple connectivity. And I don't trust my neighbor, even though I had to forward through that neighbor, et cetera, et cetera. So this means that the inter-domain routing is more concerned with policy routing. It's concerned with basic connectivity. That's why you can't expect much end-to-end today in the internet. Okay. So with that note, we'll just stop for this half of class. We'll continue after 10 minutes for the next half of class.